Mawson and Batavia, a couple of recent ones. Have you switched it on?
Switched it on. Is that now? That's now working.
Yes. And you've come across. Peter's come across for the Perth Writers Festival.
Yeah.
Ian used to be an atheist until the age of 19, and since then he's been a pastor and a chaplain, and he now goes around Australia speaking at events like this for City Bible Forum. So if you have questions here today, then this is very much your event. How things go depends on you. There's two ways that you can submit your questions. The first is to send a text. The number will come up on the screen in just a moment. Write that down, because that's not going to stay up there the whole time. It's in your handouts as well, but if you want to send a text, you can send it to that number, and it'll get to the panel through that. Or if you want to write it down on that slip, if you've got a handout, you can write it down and just pop your hand up when the time comes. And Lainey, who's going to pop her hand up for a second, will come down the aisle and grab your question. So how things go very much depends on the questions that come in today. But I thought we might kick off with a question for Peter. You've described yourself as a devout atheist. How did you become a devout atheist?
All right, well, thank you for the invitation to address you. I was born and bred on a farm north of Sydney, Pete's Ridge, a citrus orchard. They say if you had a happy childhood, you remember the sun shining. If you had an unhappy childhood, you remember wet Wednesday afternoons. I remember the sun shining. I was the youngest of seven children. My father was a very devout Christian and a very, very good man. My mother was a very, very good woman, a saint, a secular saint, as my brothers and sisters think of her. I went to Sunday school every second Sunday. Between times, I went to church. I was raised in a very strong Christian household with fabulous parents. At the age of 14 or 15, I read a book called The Best of Bertrand Russell. And to quote Bob Dylan, one of Bob Dylan's songs, and every one of them words rang true and glowed like burning coals. So Bertrand Russell was the first time I was encouraged to not simply accept the faith that had been given to me, but to analyse it, to think about it. And from the moment that I started thinking about it and analysing it, it became a drug, and a very pleasurable drug, which was the sheer ludicrousness of the belief that there is a big man above the clouds watching us and listening to us. It is very pleasant in this church. When I came in here, I went, this smells like a church. It's nice, it's shady, it's a nice sense of community, and I'm delighted to be here. But I suppose I first started writing about atheism in my column in the Sun Herald maybe 10 or 15 years... Well, firstly in the Sydney Morning Herald. I have a pet aversion to sports people like Aaron Baddeley saying, thank you, Jesus, for letting me win today. I find that the height of arrogance. And I started writing about that, and then I moved on to other things. I find... Look, I don't find things... offensive is not the right word, but I do get engaged in very earnest discussions with people who email me. And as I'm saying this, given that you are attending here today in a church, it's my fair bet that many of you are Christians. I mean no offence, but I will say this, that I can't remember who first came up with the line, but it's a line I quote frequently. There have been 10,000 gods worshipped by man since the dawn of time. Christians, you Christians, and if there are Islamic people here, hello, and if there are Jewish people here, hello, religious people. I'll start with Christians though. Christians have rejected 9,999 of them as complete and arrant nonsense. I've just counted up on the way here, and I worked out we're very close. I have rejected just one more than you as complete and arrant nonsense. And I encourage you to think about it, to consider the notion that there really is a big man above the clouds listening to us now and watching us. I put it to you, in the 21st century, when we think about it, that is absurd. It doesn't mean we can't be good people. We can be good people, but let's be good people, not because of an absurd belief that we're going to get eternal life if we're good and go to hell if we're bad. Let's be good people because it's in our nature as humans. Thank you.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I don't think you're going to offend anyone today. I think there will be Christians here, but by no means necessarily the majority, and I think we're all here because we want to explore this important question. We'll come back to why, whether it's an important question or why you think it's an important question, but I wanted to ask the same thing of you, Ian. You, until the age of 19, were an atheist. Why did you then become a Christian? What happened?
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't think every time a person says, I once believed this and now I believe that, not everything's evolution upward, you can devolve. So that I used to be X and am now Y is not necessarily progress. I was a very happy atheist. I had not dissimilar to Peter, a very, very happy childhood. I was leaving school in 73, and frankly, if you were from the moderately loved and at a reasonably good school and da-da-da in Sydney, and you couldn't be happy in 73, you must have had some real problems. Sexually transmitted diseases were gone as far as we were concerned. Vietnam was over.
They weren't gone by 1984.
No, they'd come back.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a great time. Unemployment was something you only read about in the Depression. The oil crisis hadn't hit then, da-da-da-da. It was a great time to be alive. And I knew some Christians. I didn't particularly like them, nor did I respect them, except one. And I didn't need a God. I was a modern man. I'd studied fairly serious biology at school. The idea of a cosmic policeman, cross-teacher, cross-father, was the last thing I needed. Religion was a comfort for the weak and the losers. And so I was very happy. And then some things happened that challenged me to think about it. And so I spent about 6 months, which isn't
what
a
happened?
Long time.
What happened?
Oh, a friend of mine I'd known since I was five drowned. We'd actually learned to swim together. Now, I went to the funeral, and I'm worried because I shared this with my oldest brother after I became a Christian, and he immediately psychologized the whole thing in a quite a silly way, I thought. I was just at the funeral, and I suddenly realized that Jack is dead. Whatever's on the other side of death, and my own conclusion was it was just food for worms, and frankly, that's a perfectly fine view. The idea that when you die, you sleep. I mean, what's to fear in that? All this nonsense about all religions are matter because of this fear of death. I like sleeping. I like going to bed tonight. The idea of dying, bully for that. But I was aware there were other views, and so I just thought I should check this out again. So I spent 6-7 months checking out three main questions. One was, is there some sort of God, intelligence, spirit, mind behind it, or is the world better explained as just a brute fact? And then, if there is there anything more that we can know about the character of, if that person has a character? Mm-hmm. And so I looked then at particularly Tibetan Buddhism and Christianity. Islam simply wasn't on the map in Australia then. And I came to the reluctant conclusion. I remember when I became a Christian in my bedroom, I was angry and I was unhappy because I don't want to be a Christian. I'm having a good time. And I thought that Christianity would be dull. So I was relieved years later when I read C.S. Lewis, who was also an atheist who became a Christian at about the age of 40 through the influence of Tolkien and his study of what myths are really like, because that was his area of study. He described himself as a reluctant Christian. He said, at least the prodigal son had the decency to walk home. I had to be dragged home. And I felt some, nothing like drawing similarities with some genius, but I thought that was my experience. So,
yeah.
So I became a Christian very reluctantly and,
I guess a prior question, an important question, but a prior question to our question for today, is there a God? Is that actually an important question? There's lots of people in Perth who'd say, I don't care, it won't make any difference. I'm not... You guys obviously think it is.
There is not, obviously, a scintilla of evidence that there is a God. Not one scintilla of evidence. And we can have all of our miracle cures, you know, the Mother in Sydney at the moment, they've got Mary MacKillop and saints have done these miracles who have disturbed the natural order. And we've got all these extraordinary cases of proof that God exists by people with terrible medical afflictions, with tumours, cancers, leukaemia, all these terrible things that God has suddenly miraculously cured or a saint has miraculously cured. And yet, there is no record whatsoever anywhere of God growing back the digit of a single small finger. Okay? If we think about that, we're saying the people that believe this nonsense are believing that by laying hands upon, he can cure tumours and all the rest. So it's miraculous, I'm saved, I'm cured, the tumour has gone, the cancer has disappeared from my body. Very, very odd, though, isn't it, that God can cure a tumour and bring somebody back to life, and yet there is nobody claiming that something that's actually demonstrable, that they could grow back the single digit of a little finger. There was a, some of you may have seen a thing on Australian Story on Monday about this woman that is one of the Catholic Church used to have, you needed three miracles to prove that somebody was a saint. Well,
let me just finish, I'll be 30 seconds.
Pope John Paul II brought it, said you actually only need two. How very odd of God, if he's going to save somebody, to save a woman that was smoking three packets of cigarettes a day and yet to kill children with leukemia at the age of two. How very odd of God. And if there is a God, I say, good on you, God. I say, terrific. But how absurd. Is your God so vain that he really needs us to bow and scrape and bend at the knee and worship him? Please. We're adults.
You haven't convinced me that this is an important question. I mean, you can come back. I'll go to Ian first and then come back to you. But on this, I think the question is important because I think there are a lot of people in Perth who go, I don't care whether there's a God or not. Makes no difference. Obviously, you've invested some of your time to be here today to talk about it. You think it's important. Why do you think it's an important question, Ian?
A 10-second detour. I'd like to go back to some of Peter's questions.
We will.
The God that he's mocking, I would want to mock with him much of it. And secondly, the God that he's having a go at about the worship stuff, that's, I don't know what God he's mocking. It's not the God of Jesus, but I'm happy to come back. We can come back to
that. We'll come back to that, yeah.
But I think, is it important? Well, it kind of depends on what God you believe in or don't believe in. Most Australians are not atheists as I was and as Peter is. They're what has sometimes been called practical atheists. You know, if you push them, they really do believe there's probably some sort of God behind it. In fact, some of my atheist friends, if you push them, one of them is a surgeon, he insists on calling himself an atheist. But when I've asked him about the surgery he does and the wonder that he does surgery on the anus, which is not the most highly regarded part of the body. But when he talks about it, the wonder of the things it can do that no other part of the body can do. And I said to him one time, we were fishing, how can you talk with wonder about that, to say nothing about the pancreas and all these other things? And he said, oh no, I believe there's a God, just not the God you're on about. I said, so you're not an atheist at all. You're an agnostic or a theist. But he keeps calling himself an atheist. Most Australians are not atheists. They're practical atheists. That is, for all intents and purposes, God may as well not be there. There are certain sorts of gods, if you don't believe in them, it doesn't matter. But Friedrich Nietzsche has got this terrific parable that he tells called the Coming of the Madman. It's worth reading. You can find it on the net easily. And Friedrich is a terrifically influential 19th century atheist. Not much of a theoretical philosopher, but more of a poet. But he has this picture of the madman coming into this village. And it's basic, and the village, they're all atheists, they've killed God. But what the madman comes in and is talking to the village atheists is, the village atheists think you can kill God and life can go on as normal. And Nietzsche's arguing, rubbish. If you kill God, eventually, maybe some generations down the road, a lot of what comes from God goes as well. So he predicted, as against the British Prime Minister and the American President, that the 20th century would be the bloodiest century in history as Europe fought some of these issues out. And certainly in terms of blood, he may well be correct. So Nietzsche says, as an atheist, if you've got the guts to be consistent, instead of nicking a whole lot of Christian values, which come out of a Christian, you want the fruit without the tree. Let me finish. Nietzsche argues that if you're a consistent atheist, it makes all the difference. We've wiped away the sun, we've wiped away the horizon. You cannot live with any consistency and courage Christian values. People do. Thank God they do. But so most of my friends from school are not Christians. They're various sorts of atheism, practical or otherwise. But they basically live as sort of Christianized atheists. But I think consistency-wise, down the track, I mean, it is true that Australia simply gives a lot less percentage-wise to charity than we did around 1910. And I think we're giving more than we did a decade ago because we're doing better charity. So I think these things play out. It's a question if you prize intellectual honesty and consistency, it makes all the difference in the world, according to Nietzsche.
With respect, Ian, it is a colossal arrogance to think that atheists nick Christian values. If by Christian values you mean being kind to other people, it is absurd for Christianity to say that is our value. We humans, we go back to evolution and Darwin and the rest of it, as communities, it's in us. It is in us to look after each other, to have tight communities. There was a very interesting thing, Alain de Botton, if I'm pronouncing that. Did you see him
That's
on the
right,
7:30
yeah.
report?
No.
It was terrific. And he was saying that there are many things with religions that are very good. The one thing he said that religion does very well is community. And I totally agree. There is a tight sense of community, and community does that very well. And when you talk about Nietzsche and predictions for the 20th century, there are two arguments here. One argument that you're arguing is the good things that perhaps religion can do. Okay, let me finish. I'll let you go. That there are things that Christianity, that Islam, that Judaism, that Hinduism, there are good things that they can do. There's no doubt about that. I'm less interested in that argument than in the argument of, is there a scintilla of proof through it? And just as passionately as you might argue for the existence of your Christian God right now, if you must realise that if you were born in Mecca, you would be arguing for Allah. If you were born in Tel Aviv, you would be arguing with equal passion for Judaism. If I wanted to put out right now an absurd belief, if I wanted to get some children to believe that this mandana had magical, magical powers, I would raise those children, and everywhere they looked, there'd be the image of a bandana, and red would be the magic colour, and I'd drill it into them, and I'd have them pray to the bandana. And after 7 years, they would be mine, and they would believe that. And so really, most of religion, when you think about it, is absolute brainwashing. And I encourage everybody to think your way through this, because it is an absurdity. And so when we all agree on the one imaginary friend, and we all say that's our imaginary friend, yes, we will have a tight sense of community. I accept that. And as to who designed the anus and who designed the eyes and who designed all kinds of things and the wonder of the world and who designed the birds and the bees and all of that, the answer is I haven't got the first clue. You haven't got the first clue. None of us know. But to quote Somerset Maugham in his fantastic book, Summing Up, he said, most religions that men invent are blind cul-de-sacs into the heart of the great mystery. You have to turn around. All religions come, I don't know who designed it all. I don't know how it all came about. But all religions are designed to come up with an answer to that. And the absurdity of thinking, I mean, there was a, you're getting nervous because I'm going too long? Give me 15 more seconds. There was one line, and you may find it offensive. But Christianity, I saw, defined as the belief that a Jewish zombie, who is his own father, can give you eternal life if you symbolically eat his flesh and his blood, on and on like that, all because a woman ate an apple from a tree that had a talking snake. Okay? It's a fair definition of it. And you may think that the Peruvians in their ancient worship and the Islamic people and the Jewish people have got absurd beliefs now. That's what you believe.
A question that's come up a couple of times is this question of proof. Okay, so Peter's stated that there's not one scintilla of proof, and dismissed the idea of modern miracles being evidence of God's existence. And you've told us a little bit about why you became a Christian age 19.
Yeah.
But I assume you've kind of grown since then. What's the main reason that you're a Christian today? If you had to give us one scintilla of proof, or one reason why you're a Christian today, what is it?
Again, a little... Peter's brought up four or five different sprays on things, and any one of which I'd be delighted to stay and unpack, because I think they're masters of huge overstatement, ridiculous caricatures and send-ups. One of the things I appreciated from an old man who taught me some years ago, he said, always, if you're going to argue with a Muslim, read the very best Islamic scholar. Don't pick the local mad mufti, but go for the very best. Read the best atheist. And I just think whether Peter knows he's doing it or I don't know, but the caricature he gives of Christianity is just nothing like what any mainline, sensible Christian has believed in 2,000 years. Now, there are a couple of words picked up and put together. But I sort of think you've got to be able to do better than that, than this sort of ridiculous caricature. I mean, I could play the same game with atheism, but it's just not a helpful honest way to deal with this. So when it comes to evidence, and let me just...
Perhaps you'd point out where I've got it wrong.
Well, I mean, the whole... It's hard to go to know, have to know which one. The guy did the...
Very
the,
hard.
The alpha male. Let me start with it. The alpha male above the clouds, watching what you do and working out if you're a good boy, you go to heaven, go to hell. I mean, that's a terrific sort of send-up, perhaps based on the Sistine Chapel, which is why I think Christians have always had a dodgy thing about Christian art. But it's Christians do not and have not ever believed that he's male. We've got to use, like French, you've got...
Please,
female windows.
You're Christians here. How many believe that God is male? Okay, so that's... Okay, there's a few. But if he's not an alpha male above the clouds, where is he? What does he do? You appear to know. Let's hear it.
If you have said
that he is not an alpha male living above the clouds,
yes,
listening to us and watching us, you clearly think I've got it wrong. So
yes,
tell us, where is he? What does he do? And what is your first scintilla of evidence?
Well, I'm not sure.
Let's hear it. Not blah blah blah
no,
blah
no,
blah.
No, it's not. Don't
articulate.
Let me have a go at answering. You've asked three questions.
Articulate.
I'll start with the third.
Let's go.
Let's go to the question of evidence. One of the parts of scientific method is inference to the best explanation. Right? That's a standard line in the methodology of science. So in all sorts of things, particularly in things where you can't do the heart and soul of science, which is to rerun the experiment. You go into a situation, this is what the Big Bang Theory is about, which is excellent science. We can't prove the Big Bang Theory from empirically. We can't run experiments. What we can do is we can see a phenomena and think, what is the best explanation of this present phenomena? And then there are a number of possibilities put up, and then you work through which one's got the best evidence. So when it comes to the question, the basic questions like, why is there something and not nothing? Why is there, when you look at life, either human life or the basic numbers of the great constant force of the universe, the fine-tuning sort of argument. The question is, does it make more sense to believe in accidentalism or that there is some intelligence? When you say there's not a shred of evidence, the problem with that is you've got men like Anthony Flew, who I'm sure you're aware of. Anthony Flew is, if Bertrand Russell was the leading atheist spokesman in the academic world in the middle of the 20th century, Anthony Flew was the leading atheistic spokesman at an academic level. He's hated by Richard Dawkins because he did what Dawkins describes as an act of treason, which is just how childish Richard Dawkins is at that point. Because in 2004, in the middle of a three-day academic debate in the university in the States, he comes out and says, I am now persuaded that there is a God. And he did it because, as he described, when Dawkins said that's an act of treason, he said, that shows something out, Richard, because we're engaged in the pursuit of that which is true and real. And he says, when I come to the conclusion that particularly looking at questions of the basic forces in the universe and DNA, which are the things that got him, the question of coding and information, which is what DNA is, what best makes sense of the universe as we know it? Many vastly intelligent people look at it and say, gee, I used to think atheism was the best, but when I look at particularly the developments of modern
science... one of the leading reasons, or the leading reason perhaps, why you are a Christian today is that theism, or the belief that there is a God, best explains the evidence of DNA or why
yes,
there's something rather than nothing.
But that's half of it, because the other thing in the end
is that
friends of mine who've done a similar trip from atheism to being Christian, for them it was simply the question of Jesus. Because in the end, I think the thing that keeps me Christian, to go back to the question that you asked that we didn't get to, it is in the end that the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus is overwhelming rationally to me. Now, and it does that, and Peter can throw up his hands or whatever, but it's done that to people like, one quick example, then chuck it back to Peter.
Yeah.
Pinchas Lapid is a great example. I pick him because he's a Jewish Orthodox scholar. He wrote a number of books about the complete failure of the Vatican to look after Jews and as a road out for Nazis. So he's no great friend of Christianity. When he turns his historic skills, finally looks at the evidence for the resurrection, he wrote a shocking book arguing that, although he's an Orthodox Jew, that the resurrection is a fact of history. And so I'm saying, when people, instead of just mocking, turn their intelligence and look at the evidence. Evidence is remarkably unconvincing until you look at it. They say, gosh, this is much better than I thought. That's what happened to me. I knew the New Testament was crap. I knew it was a myth. It was a hopeless, and so I'm saying the evidence is powerful again and again to men more intelligent and better looking.
So
maybe a few women as well. I invite those who are following this with an open mind to have followed that argument to note that there was no answer, absolutely no answer whatsoever to my question of if I've got God wrong of an alpha male above the clouds, tell me who he is, what he is, how he works. There was absolutely no answer to that. Let me finish. I let you go. The evidence presented was this fellow and that fellow and another fellow who used to be atheist turned Christian. That is no argument whatsoever. The Islamic world can come up with exactly that number of people. The Jewish world can come up with it. That is not an argument because people we've never heard of have changed their minds. That is not evidence for an argument, and it does not belong in what is hopefully an intellectual debate. I'd also note that when you talked about your scientific system of we can't prove the Big Bang, but we look for a theory that fits with the world we know. I again go back to it. I don't know what we're doing here. I don't know what it's about, and neither do you. But the Christians here have embraced a model where a Jewish zombie who is his own father can give us eternal life if we symbolically eat his flesh and drink his blood, all because a woman took an apple from a tree which had a talking snake in it. So there is, and that's not my original, that came from somebody I can't remember, but that is, so there we've got this world, this fabulous world that we're so fortunate to live in, and you working back have come up with, that's what I believe. And my friends, it is absurd. It is a total and obvious and transparent nonsense. And if I were to believe that there were fairies at the bottom of my garden, I wouldn't expect you to take me seriously. And I cannot take seriously the notion of an all-seeing, all-knowing God that arrived, that has been here since the dawn of... Anyway, the whole thing.
You've got a little bit of knowledge of historical methods. So you've done some modern history, you've written about Tobruk, Kokoda, other historical events. How do you respond to the historical argument that a guy was dead on a Friday and then he was alive again on the Sunday? That was one of Ian's reasons why he's still a Christian, came back to life.
And a lot of people have said to me, it's about the resurrection, it's about the resurrection, Jesus is the only man that ever resurrected, etc., etc., etc. Okay, what about Lazarus did it? And Christopher Hitchens makes the point that I think it's in the Old Testament or the New Testament, I get mixed up between the two, I'm not a biblical scholar by any means. But there was a whole city that was raised from the dead at much the same time that Jesus was. It's not, in the words of Christopher Hitchens, if you go Christopher Hitchens and resurrection and banal, it was actually rather banal, it was happening everywhere. Okay, and do that.
On the question of... Okay, well, we'll leave those other things aside, which might be persuasive proofs in themselves. But Jesus, dead on a Friday, crucified, spear went through his side, according to the historical record.
Alive again. Okay, I'll say this. In the historical record, I do work, and I'm writing at the moment on the Eureka Stockade. And what I treasure, what I want accounts that are written, contemporaneous accounts that are written at the time. So when I'm doing Tobruk, I want diaries, I want letters, I want that which was written at the time. The Bible was written by hearsay 80 years after the event. It is not an historical record. It is not something that it's encompassed all kinds of theories and myths around at the time from all kinds of society. But to take it as holy writ is absurd. And what I most resent is when people like Margaret Court, for example, use the Bible, cherry-pick the Bible out of Leviticus, whatever it is that a man won't lay with a man or a woman won't lay with a woman, and say, this is my justification for homophobia. Tell me how the Christian God, who is all-seeing and all-knowing, can create gays but hate gays. How does that work? And why did he create Islamic...
We could come back to the question of suffering or homosexuality or many other questions that have been raised, and perhaps we will in future panels. But on this question of Jesus, is he alive? Did he come back to life on the Sunday? 80 years afterwards, is that a fair... I mean, what's your understanding of historical method and the conclusion?
Just one thing first, and that is when I mentioned Pinchas Lapide and Anthony Flew, I was not saying these well-known academics who've changed their mind, therefore you should... at all. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying it is worth considering that this is not as self-evidently stupid as you send it up to be. Because when men, and they are men, that's why I use the word men, when men, that these men have looked at the evidence, they've been persuaded. Pink Estepy didn't become a Christian, which was a surprise to people.
So, no, that's what I'm saying.
What I'm saying is, I just didn't want the argument to be misunderstood. We're dealing with, as you know, huge topics in a split second, and that's tricky. And I haven't answered some of the things you said, and you had to go at me for that, but it's because you asked three separate questions, and I took the third.
Give me an argument. An argument
about what?
Argument.
About what in particular? Asked me a question.
I got the question on respond. Do you want to respond to what he said about?
When Peter says 80 years, that's just historical nonsense. Find an ancient historian, at any of our universities here, Macquarie, Sydney Uni, who believes that the gospel accounts are written 80 years after. That's the very best of 19th century thought. Now, it turns up on SBS and ABC and documentaries. It's just nonsense. There's a fella called. These are documentary questions about how old the documents are. There are two questions in terms of historical reliability. Does the person who writes the account of Jesus, is he in a position to know? Two or three of the Gospels claim to be eyewitnesses like John. Luke specifically tells you he's not. If he was interested in just lying, a good story could have, but he actually says he talked to the eyewitnesses like you do. So Luke will tell you he wasn't an eyewitness. He talked to them. John says and can prove, I think scholars are convinced that John is because of I can give you some of the evidence if you want, but the view you've got is it's the mythology that I was brought up in, that the New Testament is self-evident historical nonsense. You don't need to read it because we all know it's nonsense. John Dixon, whose doctorate is in ancient history, lectures at Sydney and Macquarie Uni, he says, generally speaking, the myths are about the New Testament, not in it. So the evidence for the resurrection is that there's two parts to the evidence that get argued by historians. The body's clearly missing. Doesn't prove a resurrection. The early Christians didn't go, body's missing, he's risen from the dead. They went, body's missing, those rats who killed him have desecrated the thing. And then the fact that they began to say and to die for, which proves sincerity, not truth, that he had risen from the dead and appeared to him. And I'm sorry, I think you do actually respect scholars. I mean, Gerd Ludemann, who's a German... Let me just put it.
Absurd.
Gerd Ludemann is... It's not absurd because we've got a split second to do... Gerd Ludemann is an atheistic scholar of the New Testament. He says, I don't know what happened, but it's very clear that the early Christians had experience of the risen Christ. He can't explain it. The one explanation is that he did actually do what he said he would do. And when people look at the evidence, as Lapide did and many others, as I did, you think... I mean, for me, it was bugger. The evidence is good. I don't want it to be true. But it's easy to mock the evidence from a distance.
It's very, very easy.
It's ignorant, though, to
no,
do
no,
it.
No, no.
It's like me saying, your book on Tobruk or Mawson, who cares it's written 50, 60 years after the event? The question is, how accurate are you in dealing with the scholarship?
You would be welcome. My book on Tobruk is an evidence-based book after trawling through
lyres.
But anything that you can prove to me, and there is one mistake that I know of in Tobruk, and there's one mistake that I know of in Mawson. How do I know it? Because I put it out there. 80,000 people, 170,000 have read Tobruk, 80,000 have read Mawson, or 65,000 Mawson, and I've made a mistake about the Torrens River in Adelaide. Okay, so it's a mistake, and I look at it, and I say, well, this is what I said, and this is what it is, and this is a mistake. And Tobruk, I made a mistake about the shiny shoes, and it's a mistake. And how do I know? Because I was using evidence, and I made a mistake, and other people bring forward evidence, and I realise my mistake, and I correct it. We can't argue like that on the Bible, and it is not an argument. If we were here arguing that 2 plus 2 equals 5, and I were to reel off a dozen people from German universities and French universities who died 100 years ago who actually said that 2 plus 2 equals 5, you know, and I know, and you know, that is not an argument. That, my friend, is mere bluster.
Okay, I'm not for a second suggesting that his books... I'm simply saying that there's a gap between you and the event does not necessarily imply the inaccuracy. I'm not suggesting that people should pick up John's Gospel or Luke's Gospel and read it as divine scripture. I'm saying just pick it up, as many have, as I did, and read as books that allege to be that, and read it. The first thing you do with a witness, I think, is actually let them have a speak.
Did you read the Quran? Did you read the Talmud?
I have read the Quran. I can't read the Talmud because my Hebrew is not too good.
An English translation.
Well, no, I've read the Torah, if that's any help.
Look,
I'm not suggesting that I've read everything that can be ever written on religion, but I'm saying I had a look and I continue to be persuaded. And one of the things that persuades me, frankly, is I keep reading. I read Bertrand Russell, I remember reading that as a young Christian, and I was fearful. I thought, this is one of the great intellects of the 20th century. I am not. His book, Why I'm Not a Christian, it's a little essay, really. And Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. And frankly, I find them disappointing. In fact, I joked with, I should write a book attacking Christianity, which actually has a go at the target. I just feel that particularly Dawkins and Hitchens, who are great writers, etc., they're like someone who says, I'm going to wipe out Sydney, and they wipe out Auckland. Well, it's a city and it's near the water. But I'm just waiting for someone to actually have a go at the target.
Tell us what the target is. Tell us my vision and how my vision is drawn.
I assume that you've read Peter and Luke and, you know, the
Gospel book. When I was a young man, not since I grew up.
Okay.
I mean, not since I've grown up. I mean, if I wrote a book about the fairies at the bottom of my garden, I frankly wouldn't expect you to read it.
But, you know, if there were some experts who were saying there are fairies at the bottom of your garden, you might
Look,
give it a reread.
But anyway,
my question, though, was from your memory of reading John, what made you think that it wasn't eyewitness testimony?
They're fabulous stories, but when you research it, everybody Google it. When was the Bible written? I mean, it's absolutely straightforward. The only people that are saying that it was a contemporaneous account are Christian scholars who are in the business of being Christian scholars. No serious historian is going to tell you that the Bible is a contemporaneous account.
John was regarded as written in the second century until they found a manuscript from the first century. You know, they found him in the... So that scholarship of the early 20th century is obviously passed. But we've got other questions. A question for you from the audience, Ian, is, as an atheist, there's no higher reason to be here. But, and this is Peter's point, that doesn't mean that our lives can't be meaningful. Why is it somehow more meaningful to be a Christian than to be an atheist?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I wouldn't want to argue that. I think you can have a really, if you're lucky in life, you can have a really good, enjoyable, meaningful life in loving people, enjoying music, and enjoying intellectual life. And that's the way I think God has made the world. You can have a great life as an atheist in our country. So I would never want to argue, and I don't think intelligent Christians have. You can find mugs who can argue anything in any position. But I think I would say that when you talk to people like Nietzsche, like Sartre, like Camus, the English atheists tend to be soft on this, when they actually in the end say that, yes, we understand life can be exciting, but when you do stop and think, what the hell is it all about, apart from just having a good time until I die, which is a legitimate thing to do. If that's all there is to life, do it. I don't think anyone should believe anything because it makes life easier. That's rubbish. Illusions are always deadly in the end. But so I think atheists can have a perfectly fine life and do all sorts of kind things. What I'm talking about is my main thing is the question of is it true? Atheism has no explanation for the really important questions that humans at some stage stop and ask. Now, if there are no answers, I agree with Peter, if there are no answers, it's always better to be an agnostic than to pretend you know and you don't. When Peter says, none of us know, he can't know that. When he quotes Somerset Maugham, it's a great quote, it's well written, but Somerset Maugham is actually pretending to be in the position where God isn't, and looking down, and who can actually say no route works. If you say to me, no plane leaving from the airport takes you to Sydney, you've got to know everything about every plane. So it's one of those things, it's a robust statement, it's beautifully written. It's vacuous because Maugham has to know 100% about God and the universe to know that his statement's true. So by all means believe it, but it's an unverified affirmation.
There's a few threads in what you said there which we could come back to.
Excuse me.
Or you want to?
Yeah. Somerset Maugham, who said that, what was it, an unverified? An unverified what?
Affirmation. Or assertion.
I mean, for a Christian man to argue that Somerset Maugham saying we don't know about anything is an unverified affirmation. Please, what is Christianity? What is Islam? What is Judaism? What is Hinduism? What is any of them, if not an unverified affirmation? Not one of them has a single scintilla of proof. And to return to my original point, if I was to take 100 children and get them to believe in absurdity, that my bandana has magical powers, what is the one value that I would put forth? There's one value to get this to propagate. I'd say, you must have faith. You've got to have faith. You've got to believe it. Why would I put that value forward? I would put that value forward so that when their intelligent, rational mind started to kick in and they started to look at the bandana and think, that's a bit odd. I'm not sure. No! You must have faith. That is the single most important value to get an absurd belief to propagate through the generations. That's the value I would choose to get people to believe something that's totally absurd, and that is the value that all religions put forward. I'll leave you with this because I think we've got 4 minutes to go. Vladimir Nabokov, the Russian writer, said, "Common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternal walls of darkness. I want my crack of light to be a rainbow crashing into a kaleidoscope factory just as a train filled with paint arrives. I want colour, I want movement, I don't want to waste a single minute of my time on absurd nonsense. Thank you."
And we did start with Peter, so we might finish with a comment from you, then
yeah.
I have 1 minute of things to say.
Yeah.
So
at
you've
one
got
level, I want
just
a strong
a minute.
Yeah.
If you
okay.
wanted to leave us with one thing for us to consider as we go, what would that one thing be?
Well, I'd do it in part A and part B then. I want to agree with Peter entirely in terms of I want to suck the marrow out of life. Any sort of religion that decries the brain which God gave us is not worthy of any so-called imaginary God. So anything that says don't use your brain is obviously false. And that certainly the Christianity that I ran into and have been a part of has always said think. And secondly, I want life. I want to live life to the max. Although, I also want to live life for that which is true. So it's hard to be a martyr for any important cause if you're just on about slipping in as much pleasure as you can, which is why Christians have got a good record in various parts of the world of standing up against oppressors. But for me, the question is Christianity's claim is that God has actually come amongst us in Jesus. When Jesus is asked twice, give us proof that, you know, your big claims, give us proof. Both times in John 2 and Matthew 12, he says, kill me and I'll come back from the dead. When people look at the evidence, instead of mocking it from afar, actually put there at Brian's and look at the evidence, it is remarkably persuasive. It's what persuaded me. So I would say to people, have a look at Jesus for yourself. I keep asking people in Sydney, have you had a chance since you became an adult to read one of the four accounts of Jesus' life? Without exception, apart from the few religious people I've met, ordinary Australian, no. They then talk about childhood. It's as an adult where we have a look at it. And I think the question is about whether or not, if he didn't rise from the dead, I want out of this thing. There is nothing to be gained by believing a lie. In fact, there's always down the road trouble. So I think, at least at one point, I think Peter and I are in agreement, that is, you've got to be realists. And also, we all want to get the most out of life. You know, any sort of religion that says, crap now, heaven then, needs to be held under deep suspicion, I think.
City Bible Forum wants to be a place for ideas. So it's been fantastic, Peter and Ian, to explore this idea with you today. And it really is very generous of these guys to give up some of their time to be here. So I want to thank them for that. If you want to keep on thinking about these ideas, there are a couple of ways you can do so. There's the forum, which meets Thursday lunchtimes. We'll keep on looking at the source documents and considering this question of whether there's a God. You might want to use the comment card in your handouts, which you can just write down any details on. If you want us to help you in thinking about these ideas, you can leave it in the box at the back. And then again, next term, we'll be thinking about some big ideas on a panel, looking at the origin of the species. Where do I come from? So see you again then.